Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. This is a recording from the monthly Oldie Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club. To book a ticket, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk/lunches.
Now, our first speaker is one of our leading biographers. Adam Sisman edited the letters of Paddy Lee Fermor. He's written biographies of A.J.B. Taylor, Hugh Trevor Roper, and John le Carré, and his latest book, widely reviewed with brilliant reviews, is The Indefatigable Asa Briggs. Ladies and gentlemen, Adam Sisman.
Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
If I may borrow a quip from one of my fellow panellists, it's a relief for once to be in a room where I'm not the oldest person. And there was a story which I was told I had to tell at the beginning about the National Liberal Club, which dates from the 19th century, concerns a Tory grandee who was accosted coming out of the gentleman's lavatory by a Liberal grandee who said, "Look here, this is a Liberal club, you know." To which the Tory grandee said, "Oh, it's a club as well, is it?" Anyway, that's the end of the joke. I promise not to be amusing for the rest of my speech. Asa Briggs, who died in 2016, is a slightly forgotten figure today. But until recently, he was one of the best-known historians in the country, an academic superstar. At the height of his fame, his name on the cover was enough to sell a book to the public in large numbers. In the mid-1980s, it was said that only Lady Antonia Fraser had the same mesmeric effect on book club members. It has to be admitted that this effect faded towards the end of his life. In old age, he no longer commanded the same respectful attention either from the public or from younger historians. The volume, based on papers given at a conference to mark his 90th birthday in 2011, was alliteratively entitled, I knew I'd trip over that, The Age of Asa. But as some of the papers themselves demonstrated, that age had passed. One of those whom I interviewed for my book commented that Asa had outlived his fame. Yet the changing perception of Asa Briggs is itself instructive, showing us something of the way we were and how different we have become. His was a story of spectacular success, of a boy from the back streets of Keighley, the son of a failed shopkeeper, who as an adult chatted with prime ministers and presidents and rearranged chairs with the Queen. He became Vice-Chancellor of Sussex University, Provost of Worcester College, Oxford, and Chancellor of the Open University. He rose to become Baron Briggs of Lewis on nodding terms with grandees invited to Ascot and Covent Garden. He lived in gracious houses, his needs supplied by staff. He flew around the world first class. But his was also a story of frustration and disappointment. Much of what he strove to achieve ended in failure. Some of this was his own fault. He took on too much, and in later life he found he could no longer juggle his commitments as once he could. And some of it he could do nothing about. The landscape around him had changed. The arc of his life describes more than just the progress of an individual. It traces the era in which he lived, what we might call the long 20th century. In this short talk, I'd like to just make a few points about Asa Briggs. The first is that he was prodigiously clever. The original clever clogs, as Gene Seaton, one of those who spoke at his memorial service, described him. His precocious talent was obvious at his Yorkshire Grammar School. He won a scholarship to read history at Cambridge and went up there just before the Second World War, reputedly the youngest undergraduate to arrive at his college, Sidney Sussex, since Oliver Cromwell. Not content with that, he enrolled at the London School of Economics without informing his Cambridge tutors, so that he was simultaneously studying history at one university and economics at another. 3 years later, he emerged with first-class degrees in both. And if anyone else has yet matched this remarkable feat, I have yet to hear about it. As well as brains, Briggs was also best blessed with inexhaustible energy, hence the title of my book, The Indefatigable Asa Briggs. His capacity for work was legendary. It's doubtful whether Briggs ever spent a truly idle moment in his life, his admiring friend Tam Dayal would write in an obituary. Even on the morning of his wedding, his best man could hear the clack-clack of Asa's typewriter as the bridegroom finished off a book review for the New Statesman. He seemed to use every available moment to write, on buses, trains, aeroplanes, or while being driven in a car. He never learned to drive himself. He was observed stealing away from dinners, later to be found writing on the kitchen table or on a convenient sofa. Briggs was responsible for, one way or another, for more than 50 books, some of them very substantial. His five-volume History of Broadcasting alone amounts to 4,000 pages. It was said of him that as he finished a book with one hand, he began a book with another book with the other. And while not literally true, this was typical of the sort of myth that spread about him. It was said, only half-joking, that a generic term for a unit of energy should be an Asa. He was a busy, bustling figure who radiated energy and vitality, seemingly always in a hurry, dictating letters to his secretary as he strode rapidly about the Sussex campus, or in the back of the car as he was being driven towards his next appointment. Briggs travelled so frequently that he earned the nickname Professor Heathrow. "He's never here," was the complaint of one of the university staff at Leeds, where he was a professor in the 1950s. While at Sussex, he was said to have conducted tutorials on the train up to Victoria, and even in the departure lounge at Gatwick. Before he became Provost of Worcester, his predecessor J.C. Masterman had written to warn Briggs that he was sometimes too ready to assist in plans and schemes and too good-natured to say no. I did consider The Man Who Couldn't Say No as a possible title for my book, but my publisher felt this might be misinterpreted. During Briggs's 15 years at Worcester, there were rumblings of discontent about his frequent absences. It was perhaps provocative of him to list travelling as his sole recreation in Who's Who entry. The Vice Provost would be heard to complain that yet again the Provost had not been present for a meeting of the college's governing body. One of his colleagues remarked grumpily that he was more likely to see Briggs on television than in Oxford. After Asa became a peer in 1976, his Oxford colleague, Hugh Trevor Roper, posed the question, "What is the difference between the good Lord and the Lord Briggs?" To which the answer was, "The good Lord is always with us." The second aspect of Asa Briggs that I want to stress is the breadth of his interests. Most academics specialise. They find an area that they want to explore and plant their flags there as an indication of the fact that they mean to settle. Briggs was not like that. He would pioneer a new area of study and then move on elsewhere, leaving others to explore the ground in detail. He was certainly an historian, but not just an historian. He seemed to be interested in everything, from literature to sociology, from public health to media studies. Briggs's wartime experiences had broadened his horizons. After leaving Cambridge in 1942, he was called up into the army and soon posted to Bletchley Park, where he became a codebreaker, working alongside mathematicians and engineers, chess and crossword champions, classicists, all sorts of extraordinary and often eccentric people, even poets. In later life, Briggs would describe Bletchley Park as my second university, where he learned the value of teamwork, that clever people working together could achieve more than individuals working alone. All his life, he strove to break down what he saw as the artificial barriers between academic disciplines and to allow students to roam wherever their interests took them. These principles inspired Briggs to redraw the map of learning in drawing up the curriculum for the new University of Sussex in the early 1960s. Instead of traditional departments, there would be schools of study. The same subject could be studied in different schools, each with a different emphasis. Briggs's work at Bletchley was deemed so important that he was never allowed time to undertake officer training. He remained an NCO, eventually promoted to the most senior rank available to a warrant officer at the age of only 23. In 1944, when the fellows of Worcester were informed that they would be interviewing a regimental sergeant major, they imagined a tall, upright man with a loud voice and a handlebar moustache. So they were surprised when by the short, dumpy, bespectacled figure with unkempt curly hair who hurried into the room. One final point I should like to make about Briggs is that he chose to study Victorian history at a time when this was distinctly unfashionable. In the immediate post-war years, modern history ended in 1832, at least it did in the older universities. The general view then was that of the Victorians was that they were self-satisfied, buttoned-up hypocrites, and all things Victorian were denigrated. The heritage of the Victorian past was rapidly being demolished. Briggs's work was part of a wider movement to reclaim the Victorian past from the condescension of critics like Lytton Strachey. Briggs was present, along with other Victorian enthusiasts such as John Betjeman, at the meeting in 1958, at which it was decided to form the Victorian Society to encourage greater appreciation of all things Victorian. Briggs stressed Victorian self-confidence. He aimed to persuade his readers to take the Victorians seriously and to recognise their achievements. In the process, he helped to change the way the public thought and felt about the legacy of Victorian times, especially Victorian architecture, the often magnificent public buildings, the town halls, the churches, the concert halls and cemeteries, the mills and other industrial buildings, and indeed the ordinary houses that many of us still inhabit today. It is due to Asa Briggs as much as to any other individual that so many such buildings are still standing. Briggs was a quintessential figure of the post-war attempt to rebuild Britain as a fairer, kinder and more equal society, with education as a driving force enabling social change. And he was close to the centre of power. During the war, while still a young man, Ace had come to know the Labour leader and future Prime Minister Clement Attlee and become friendly with a prominent politician of the next generation, Roy Jenkins, a colleague at Bletchley. In the early 1950s, he worked as a historical advisor on Winston Churchill's multi-volume History of the English-Speaking Peoples. And in Leeds, he came to know local politicians of both major parties, including Dennis Healey and Sir Keith Joseph. By the time Labour returned to power in 1964, Asa was on first-name terms with most of the cabinet, and when he wrote to the Prime Minister, he addressed him, Dear Harold. Wilson chose Asa, to be on the planning committee for one of his pet projects, the University of the Air, later known as the Open University. Asa became a member of the great and the good, a man who could be relied upon to chair a committee and to see a project through. Briggs's last years were overshadowed by a struggle to fulfil his commitment and to fend off pressure from those unhappy that he had not done so. And in some cases he failed altogether. In others the results were substandard. It was an undignified end. He seemed unable to relax or retire. Right up till the time he died, he felt compelled to write, though by the end it had become a torment to him. This is perhaps a lesson to writers everywhere not to go on too long, and it seems an appropriate moment for me to stop. As a former broadcaster used to end his talks, if you have been, thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter Old Trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter Old Trial.